Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It seems appropriate at this point to ask who's not getting bailout money. Banks are, of course. Car makers, yes. AIG, the big insurance company as well, because it was tied up with all the rest of them. And as of today, regular old life insurers, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. American Public Media programs explore the American dream and ask, after our current troubles are over, what's next? More at nextamericandream.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday once again, everybody, the 15th of May this time. Glad to have you with us. The thing about the bank bailout, the TARP, is that it was only really about banks for about the blink of an eye. Last fall, the Treasury Department extended its definition of who was eligible for a slice of that $700 billion pie. Life insurance companies were invited to apply because, in some ways, they're more like banks than not, as in, they, too, have some troubled assets on their books. Last night, Treasury revealed six insurance companies are eligible for about $22 billion in taxpayer money. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is on the bailout beat today.
The six include some household names like Hartford Financial, Allstate, and Lincoln National. The two applying for money so far, Hartford and Lincoln, want $3.4 and $2.5 billion, respectively. Insurance analyst Jeff Schumann at Keefe, Bruyette & Woods says all the companies on the list have vulnerable investment portfolios.
Those portfolios are generating a lot of credit losses. But in addition, the life insurers have some business lines that are generating losses as well. In particular, they've sold a lot of variable annuities with some guarantees that have played out well for customers but are pretty costly for the companies.
Schumann says insurance companies will also need the government money to cover commercial real estate investment losses over the next 2 years. Banks welcome the expansion of the government bailout. Steve Bartlett is the president of the Financial Services Roundtable Trade Association. He says including life insurers will speed up the recovery.
It's not just the banks, but it's the banks and the securities market and the life insurance market. It's all connected. Unless you build and shore up all of the pieces of the foundation, then you end up with gaps and then the economy will be slower to start.
The Treasury Department says the TARP fund has over $120 billion left in it, even after setting aside money for insurance companies. Some of the remaining funds come from banks that have already paid their money back. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Google had a bit of a problem for a couple of hours yesterday. There were scattered reports of users not being able to search or use email on the site. Considering that Google gets 9 billion search requests a month, scattered really does add up. And that goes for companies as well as for you and me. For businesses, Google searches can be money in the bank. But ever since Google started selling ads in the space above its list of search replies, there's been a game of can you top this going on. And the answer is yes, you can, for the right price. Companies have been able to top their competitors, literally, by paying to have their ad come up when the name of the competition is searched. Janet Babin reports now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
Let's say you want to buy software from FirePond. So you type the name into Google, and the first thing that comes up is an ad for FirePond's competitor, Big Machines.
You may end up doing an order with big machines thinking you're doing a business with our company.
That's attorney Scott Klein of Andrews Kurth. He represents Firepond. This week, it filed a class action suit against Google. Klein says the way Google sells advertising linked to another company's trademarked name is wrong.
We're harmed both by the confusion to the consumer, that potential customer that we never got, and our competitor using our trademark illegally to gain business.
Firepond isn't the first company to raise the issue, but Professor Stacy Dogan at Northeastern University School of Law says Firepond could be in for a fight.
Even though trademark holders feel like it's unfair to them when big companies like Google get some financial benefit by using their mark, trademark law doesn't condemn it. In fact, it encourages it as long as there's no confusion.
Google makes a hefty profit selling ads linked to trademarks. It auctions off space above the search to the highest bidder. Louis Foreman's a branding expert at Inventus.
Based on the auction model that Google has created, there will continue to be increase in costs until you reach that kind of breaking point.
Firepond has apparently hit that point. It's hoping its case goes all the way to a jury. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Search Dow Jones Industrial Average today, and the arrows are going to point down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you have a look at the numbers on the auto dealer closings from Chrysler and General Motors, you can kind of see their rationale. Almost 800 Chrysler dealers got the bad news yesterday, but the company says they only account for about 15% of sales. The 1,100 GM dealers who were told today work out to about the same percentage, slightly higher. But statistics don't really mean much to those who are caught up in the mix. Marketplace's Amy Scott went to see a Connecticut Chrysler dealer who didn't make the cut.
I stopped by Amiral Motors in Newtown, Connecticut this morning. In the showroom, a glass case displays a letter. It's from Chrysler, congratulating Amiral on becoming one of the company's five-star dealers. It's dated November 2000. Today, taped to the front of that glass case, is another letter that arrived yesterday. It announces that as of next month, Amiral will no longer be a licensed Chrysler dealer.
And it's just to show you the signs of the time. Comparing how great they thought we were and how quickly they've changed their mind.
Catherine Freitas is Amiral's general manager. Her dad, Daniel Amiral, took over the business from his father, who started it in the 1930s. Amiral says he expected the news. He only sells the Chrysler brand, no Jeep or Dodge, and Chrysler had said it would target single-brand dealers. Still, he says it hurt to get that letter.
No, well, the UPS driver, which I know, delivered it to me. You know, I says, uh-oh. And it said something like, dealer only. So I kind of knew, oh, this is it.
Up until about 9 years ago, Amiral did a pretty brisk business. They sold a dozen or so new cars a month, plus used cars, and they ran a busy repair shop. But customers started complaining about the reliability of Chrysler vehicles. They wanted hybrid cars, and Freitas says Chrysler had nothing to offer them.
I'm constantly asking people who are dropping off cars for leases, would you like to see something else? Can I show you something else and, you know, that we have available? And they've already purchased other makes, other models. Nope, I'm dropping my lease return here and I'm going over to Honda to pick up my minivan.
Now Freitas says Amiral Motors sells maybe a car a month, not enough to keep Chrysler's support. In Newtown today, locals took the news hard. Dan Amiral serves in the local government, and his dealership supports several community groups. Herb Rosenthal is former first selectman, like the mayor. He bought a Chrysler from Amiral last year. It's still under warranty, and now he'll have to take it to another town for any repairs. Rosenthal says small communities will suffer as dealers around the country close.
If you look in any newspaper, the three biggest advertisers are banks, real estate, and automobiles. Banks are in trouble. Housing is down. And now to lose a lot of car dealerships, I think, will not only impact Newtown's economy, but the whole country to lose these dealers.
Amiral may have lost its license to sell new Chryslers. But as with many dealerships, the family has no plans to shut down.
This is an original lock and key.
One idea Freitas has is to develop what's been a side business, selling vintage parts. Amaral Motors may try to team up with another manufacturer or even start a non-auto business. Dan Amaral says he'll keep the repair shop open.
I've been here, I'd say, all my life in the garage business, washing cars, starting, came right up through the ranks. So I won't say the era has ended, but now it's going to change.
The change won't be immediate. Amaral and his daughter plan to keep all their employees on the payroll. They've still got three new Chryslers on the lot to sell. As for the Chrysler sign out front, they expect the company to send someone out to take it down sometime next month. In Newtown, Connecticut, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Until, about Tuesday or so, there was some distinct economic optimism going on out there. Things had been going pretty well in the markets. Earnings reports and economic indicators had been, if not good, then less bad anyway. But then we learned consumers still aren't spending. Foreclosures hit another record. And, by the way, a whole lot of car dealers were told they'll have to close down. So to help us do our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, Megan McArdle from the Atlantic's Business Channel is here. So is Mike Mandel, chief economist for Business Week magazine. Hi, guys.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Megan, I want to start with you and ask what seems to be the question of the day. Is it getting worse more slowly, or is it just worse after the week we've had?
I think that this week the green shoots started to look a little brown and straggly. You know, we've had a series of bad indicators, and it's interesting. I was actually just at a lunch where I heard an economist say, well, you know, if you take Chrysler out of the layoff numbers, then they look better. It's like, well, yeah. If I throw a lot of companies out, they probably looks
right,
better.
Right.
I think it's hard to tell, and at best, I think what it looks like now is a flattening out.
Mike, let me throw the indicator question to you. I mean, obviously, there are the jobs numbers, and there's housing, and there's, you know, inflation and all that. What, when you start to try to think about this stuff, whether it's getting worse more slowly, what do you look at?
Well, what I do is I break out the different parts of the economy. I think the stock market is probably close to a bottom, and we may see gains in GDP growth towards the end of this year. But the housing market is going to be dead for years. I don't even look at the housing numbers. I just assume that we're years away, really, from any recovery there. The real question is the job market. And the fact is that we're in the middle of a total collapse of the professional college-educated labor market that we have never seen before. And I think the labor market is going to be bad for quite some time, and that's really the kind of the big problem now.
Megan, let me ask you about something you wrote earlier this week, and you were doing a little historical comparison with the Great Depression and where we are today. And you pointed out that, you know, if you look at where the Great Depression was 18 months into a recession, they had this little burble of life, and then it just kept getting worse.
Right. And I think that something that you have to remember is that all of these things, they're mysterious and they don't play out along some script. I think a lot of people have in their head the post-World War II recession model, and that's not the kind of recession we're in. Financial crises, they look different. They're a little bit more idiosyncratic. But, you know, the average recovery time from a financial crisis is that things get worse for at least 2 years. Well, the financial crisis was last fall, which would seem to indicate that we've still got some run yet. And I think you do see in Japan and in the Great Depression these sequential things where people think, ah, finally, we've hit the bottom. And then you get a little bit of optimism, and then people realize that they still don't have a job, and they're still afraid of the future, and they pull back again. And I worry that that may happen to us.
Mike, let me ask you about the inflation numbers that were out this week. Wholesale inflation and consumer prices, not a whole lot of movement, down just a tad. I wonder what you think of this theory, that maybe what the economy could use right now is a little bit of inflation. Prices maybe creeping up just a tad?
We're in a financial crisis in part because we borrowed a lot of money from overseas that we couldn't pay back. We still are. We're still running a trade deficit. And so rather than looking at the CPI or the PPI, I keep my eye on whether or not the trade deficit numbers are shrinking. And the number that we got this week didn't go down any further, and that worries me a little because I want to see us stop borrowing from overseas before I think that we're getting close to digging our way out.
Yeah. Let me see if I can sum up the last couple of minutes of our collective lives here. Megan, you're just gloomy, right?
Well, I mean, I think part of what you have to think about is when you think about a financial crisis and what the government does, I think I agree that what's hopeful is that we're not doing the things we know were a bad idea about the Great Depression or about Japan. But what we don't know is whether just not doing the things that we have a pretty good idea didn't work is enough to get us out of this. And one other thing that we have to worry about is politically, are we going to be able to keep this up? And one thing that you see in both Japan and in the Great Depression is that, you know, there's stimulus and then it starts getting withdrawn because politically the pressure, once things start getting a little better, politically the pressure to withdraw the stimulus comes before, say, a sustainable recovery. And so it's, I think there are still a lot of clouds on the horizon.
Michael Mandel at Business Week magazine. Megan McArdle, she edits the Atlantic Magazine's Business Channel website. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, when retirement means not retiring.
For older people, the only real option to improve their financial resources is to work longer.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 0.75%, 62 points today, closed at 8,268. The NASDAQ fell 0.5%, 9 points, finished at 1680. The S&P 500 closed down 0.1%, 10 points, met the bell at 882. Allstate led insurers lower on that bailout news. The company fell 3.75%. The Hartford dropped 1%. Lincoln National fell 0.75%. Banks took a beating too. Wells Fargo lost more than 3% today. Bank of America slumped 5.75%. Citigroup fell nearly 2% today. News that General Motors will close thousands of dealerships over the next 18 months sent the company's stock skidding. It traded down more than 5%. Ford drove up more than 6% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-notes rose to 3.1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington. He meets with President Obama at the White House. The House Energy and Commerce Committee holds a hearing to begin markup of the American Clean Energy and Security Act of 2009. And on May 18, 1980, after many years of peace and quiet, Mount St. Helens blew its top. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. About the only constant that we've been able to count on through this recession is that most of us have been really bad at predicting what's going to happen next. That's kind of a problem if you consider that the economy, especially on a personal level, is largely about what happens next. This week, our series, The Next American Dream, has been looking at how people are reinterpreting that dream in light of a changing economy. We've talked about education and housing. Today, the prospect of a safe and secure retirement. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton tells us that that, too, might be a victim.
56-year-old Meredith McKenzie calls herself a typical baby boomer.
There were lots of us. We like to live large. We're very competitive. And I was no different than anybody else.
During the good years as a Southern California real estate agent, McKenzie earned a little more than six figures. No millionaire, but as a single widow, she could afford to rent an upscale beach house and spend freely.
I think I bought into something that everybody bought into, which was a definition of the American dream as being more, 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 and an economic society that said grow, 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 grow.
But like most baby boomers, McKenzie forgot to save, save, save. Then the real estate market crashed.
So there was just no possibility to make any money in real estate because there was no way to close a deal.
With nothing but debt to her name, Mackenzie's dreams of spending her later years golfing and traveling vanished. She was now just another baby boomer with no prospects for retirement.
I need sample the water person and take the temperature person. Who wants to do which?
But instead of trying to recoup her losses, Mackenzie got a job at a nonprofit that pays less than half of her former earnings. As a program manager at the Arroyo Seco Foundation in Pasadena, she's heading up efforts to restore an industrial stretch of river to its former glory.
You've got the beaker, and you're pretty much going to want to fill the beaker up.
Okay.
And then rinse it out. And
this
then
morning, Mackenzie and her team are testing water quality where the Los Angeles and Arroyo Seco rivers converge. It's a graffitied trench with a trickle of polluted water flowing down the middle. Unfazed, Mackenzie rolls up her jeans and wades in.
Well, if you look at my life 2 years ago, I was, you know, schmoozing people and sitting in fancy restaurants, and today I'm down and dirty and back to nature about as much as you can get back to nature in the city.
Retirement expert Mark Friedman is the author of Encore, Finding Work That Matters in the Second Half of Life. He says Mackenzie is at the front end of a trend that could redefine retirement.
If the old dream was the freedom from work, maybe the new dream is the freedom to work, to be able to continue contributing in ways that pay the bills and provide health insurance, but also provide a new sense of meaning and the opportunity to use your accumulated experience in ways that matter.
But that freedom isn't something that happens overnight. Mackenzie began volunteering on river restoration projects more than a decade ago, after the death of her husband. And even after jumping in full time, she quickly discovered that old dreams and lifestyles can be hard to give up, starting with her home.
So here it is, all maybe 250 square feet.
Mackenzie now rents a one-room converted garage in Pasadena.
I think after I moved in here the first month, I actually one night sat down and cried and said, what have I done? What have I done? Oh my goodness.
She saw her life as a failure, but then something happened.
First of all, my stress level has gone down about 90%. Because when you're stressing out trying to figure out how you're going to make your nut of $6,500 a month while you're watching your opportunity to make money drop, that's extremely stressful. And all I can say is that, wow, once you get that debt relief and that stress off your back, it's really liberating. Really liberating.
Oh, hey, Pam.
Once a month, Mackenzie and her closest friends get together for lunch and to catch up. Pamela Brohl has known Mackenzie for 30 years and even got into real estate because of her. But she hasn't always shared Mackenzie's positive outlook.
I was worried about her.
Brohl has decided to stay in real estate, hoping the housing market will turn around so she can maintain her lifestyle.
I don't think I could have done what Meredith did. You know, I just need more security. But it is scary. I have to say, I think all of us feel nervous. What are we going to have? What are we going to do? Are we going to have to be slaving ourselves to the ground till we're 80? You know, so all of us have to simplify, right?
Mackenzie's 60-year-old friend Kathleen Buchanan isn't as worried. She's got a federal pension. So when Mackenzie first announced her career change, Buchanan thought her friend had gone off the deep end. But now she says it makes sense.
I'm very supportive of Meredith's current transition because for a while there she was following the money, and now I think she's following her heart, and I think it's going to bring her treasure as well.
Or maybe not. A few months ago, California froze the funding for Mackenzie's position at the Arroyo Seco Foundation. In the meantime, she's working for free, making enough money on the side consulting and teaching to pay her meager rent. And then there's always real estate and her unused law degree to fall back on.
We're in a time of a lot of change and chaos, and I don't think anybody can plan anything. I think all you can do is get up every day and do the best you can.
Mackenzie says just having a plan B is no longer enough. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
All right, so what do you do, whether you have a plan B, like Sam suggested, or not? And given the massive layoffs and structural changes to the economy, how can you set yourself up for a better retirement? We played Sam's piece for Alicia Munell. She runs the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. And then we asked her if it's going to be possible ever for a lot of Americans to retire.
Even before this crisis happened, we were hearing a lot about people who felt that they were not prepared for retirement. And surveys showed that people have a lot of anxiety about their ability to support themselves in retirement.
Is it that people actually don't have enough to support themselves, or they think they don't have enough?
the key issue is what came out in your story is, do you want to maintain the lifestyle you've had while you were working? And if you were going to do that, that requires a lot of money. And we've done an analysis that indicated that more than 40% of households would not be able to maintain their lifestyle. Your person decided to change lifestyles, and that's one of the adjustments you can make. You can do more on the money side, or you can do reductions on the expense side.
Yeah, doing more on the money side, you mean work longer, right?
For older people, the only real option to improve their financial resources is to work longer. People who got caught in this downdraft in their 50s simply don't have time to increase their savings by an amount that would be sufficient. Your savings rate would have to be so high that you wouldn't have enough to live on. So the only option is to stay in the labor force longer.
Is it something that can be solved by sitting down with a spreadsheet and you and your spouse literally spending some time going over these items?
I think it's really important to do the very simple exercise of figuring out how much money you're spending now. A lot of people don't know that. And then looking at where you're spending it and to see if there are sort of easy ways of cutting back, or if cutting back really means cutting into the bone. And there, a major change may be less painful than staying where you are and sort of nickel and diming yourself.
This is kind of a tricky notion, but is it possible that the recalibration of lifestyles that some people are having to do because of this recession might actually help them out when it comes to retirement time?
All of us, in the wake of this financial crisis, have just put a halt to all spending, and that isn't particularly good for the economy, but it's probably good for all of us to think that we were buying things we didn't really need.
What happens, though, if we go back to our old spendthrift ways in 18 months when the economy is at least a little bit better?
No, if we revert to our old ways of buying things on the spur of the moment and thinking that we can stop working whenever a new young boss comes in who we don't like, then people are going to be in real trouble in retirement because Social Securities can provide less going forward, even under current law. The balances in 401k plans are modest and have not been increasing dramatically, and people don't have much other savings. So if we've learned some flexibility, that will make retirement much easier. If we go back to our old ways, retirement's going to be a real challenge for a lot of people.
Alicia Munell, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Alicia Munell is the director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. That interview and all the other stories in our series, The Next American Dream, are at our website at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today to pick up on the theme of the week, whether the economy is less bad now than it's been in a while and where it might be going. For that, I direct your attention to the oil trading pits at the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm sure you've noticed the rise in gas prices the past couple of weeks, yes? That has been matched or perhaps caused by a similar rise in the price of a barrel of crude. Almost $60 at one point this week as traders began to speculate, and I use that word intentionally, speculate that things are turning around. Well, they gave that up today as well as giving up more than $2 in the price of a barrel. Crude closed at $56.34 today in New York. We close right here in Los Angeles. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 62 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ lost 9 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 also dipped 9 points. That is 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance program, Marketplace Money, the place that launched a million dreams of retirement.
The key to Sun City's future, the next 50 years, is really in our embedded in our ability to cling to our past. Unfortunately, as people move here, they're all too often having to work.
The reworking of retirement and the next American dream. We will see you on Monday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a good weekend.
American Public Media. all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.